Okay. Reb Chaim. So it's hard not to be excited about this one. For two reasons. One, because he's Reb Chaim, but second, because he's ours. Like, let's just do the simple genealogy. Okay? Reb Chaim's father was the Beis Halevi. Okay? Reb Chaim's son was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. They're all Soloveitchiks because it's their last name. Okay? Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's son was Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, otherwise known to us as the Rav. Okay? His son-in-law was somebody we know as Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, whose son, once again, was Rav Moshe, our Rav Moshe.
Yeah.
Huh? So it's all good. Okay, so he's ours. And even though we think of, like, you know, Brisker learning as starting with the Beis Halevi or starting with Reb Chaim, because Reb Chaim was married to the Netziv's granddaughter, that makes him part of that world, and that makes him part of Reb Chaim Volozhiner's world, that makes him part of the Groz world. So it's all one world, and we're living in it. Okay. As I said, the Beis Halevi was the father of Reb Chaim. Beis Halevi's name was? They all repeat. Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. The names just keep repeating. If you go to Brisk now, everybody who has a son, the Brisk is from Rav Yosef Dov Halevi. Except it's not called Rav Yosef. Not till the kid grows up and becomes Rav. But you know what I'm saying? Okay. Now, the Beis Halevi, again, the father of Chaim, lost out essentially to the Netziv to be Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. So he was there for a while, but then it didn't work out. It's actually like this part of history that's really not discussed a lot, the competition between the Netziv and the Beis Halevi. But anyway, they moved from Volozhin and they moved to Slutsk, where Reb Chaim was educated. It's interesting, just the circle kind of completes itself. Reb Chaim was eventually invited back to be a Ram in Volozhin and maybe to be the assistant Rosh Yeshiva, and he was there when it closed. So like his father was there when it's in the early days of the Yeshiva, when it was in its glory days. Reb Chaim came back, but Reb Chaim came back when it was closed. Okay, Reb Chaim had two sons. Anybody know? The one I discussed already, Rav Moshe, who moved to America. And Rav Velvel. Okay? Otherwise known as? The Grizz. Okay? He's another son. They could not be any different. Huh? Don't worry about it. Write it in Yiddish. Okay? Now again, Rav Moshe is the father of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and the Rav. Rav Velvel is the father of everybody named Yosef Dov and Meir and Avram Yoshua. The whole Brisk world in Yerushalayim now are the direct descendants of the Grizz. Okay. Now, Reb Chaim and all branches of the family were anti-Zionists. Okay, there's no denying that. Okay? The Rav, of course, changed that. So Rav Schechter would tell you that the Rav didn't really change anything. They were anti-Zionists. Then World War II came, and anybody who was smart in World War II became a Zionist. Okay, that's what Rav Schechter would tell you. I don't know if it's right or not. I'm just saying, I would like to believe that if Reb Chaim lived 80 years later, he would have been a Zionist. But, I think it's making it up. And the fact is, they were not Zionists at the time. They were as Haredi gets. You know, they were against all these things. Okay, what makes Reb Chaim so unique? Like, what makes Reb Chaim Reb Chaim? Let's talk about that. Okay, great. He was a genius. There were other people who were geniuses also. He was a man of MS. There were other people who were men of truth. He did chesed. So did other people. We'll come back to that because I'm not so sure I agree with this anymore. But according to Rav Zevin, who wrote a piece on Reb Chaim in a sefer called Ishin Vishitos, it's a wonderful sefer about the Derech HaLimud of Achronim, he said Reb Chaim was essentially a Rishon. What does it mean that he was a Rishon? It means that he drilled down to principles. The benefit of being a Rishon is you didn't have to deal with all the Achronim Torah, right? Because you came first. Literally, you were first. he basically was first. He didn't quote a lot of Rishonim. He certainly didn't quote a lot of Achronim. In the Sefer, you have, you know, the Rambam and the Ravid, and occasionally some Tosfosim, but that's it. Okay? So according to Rav Zevin, you know, Reb Chaim was able to drill down to the beginning or to the fundamentals of a sugya. And when he's finished, you know, it's clear why the Rambam thought what he thought, why the Ravid thought what he thought. They had no choice, right? He's not there to defend the Rambam. He's there to explain how the Rambam had to hold the way he does, how the Ravid had to hold the way he does. And we'll do more about this in a second. There's a famous story from a Meir Bar Ilan who said that, you know, Reb Chaim gave a shiur, and some Rav came to him afterwards and said, but Tosfos says the following, which would have schlugged up his shiur. And Reb Chaim said, there is no such Tosfos. And they looked it up, b'kach hava. Okay, so how does that work? So Reb Chaim told Reb Meir Bar Ilan that it's not he knows every Tosfos. Of course he doesn't know every Tosfos. He said, but if you understand the sugi, you understand it's impossible that Tosfos would have said that. It's as simple as that. He said, it's not, I couldn't think of the Tosfos, but I know he couldn't have said it. Okay. When people describe Brisker Lumdus as being too dinim, so Briskers don't like that because it sounds simplistic, and it is. The number two doesn't matter. The fundamental understanding of the sugya matters. So if you're a B'chaim, and now get into Brisker Lumdus, if you're a B'chaim, you know, La'asuke Shmaitza Aliba de Hilchasa isn't what interests you in learning. Right? To understand the sugya is what interests you. He's interested in conceptual thought. The Rav once said that Reb Chaim dragged Yoredeya out of the kitchen and made it part of Lamdus, meaning that the issues of Basar B'chalav, they're not issues of Basar B'chalav, they're issues of fundamental understanding of Halacha, which can be explained and thought about in all different ways. Okay, let's look at some examples and see if we can't just talk a little bit about Brisker Lamdus. Okay, the Mishnah says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ein bir chametz ela sreifa, right? The only way you can get rid of chametz is through sreifa. V'chachamim omrim af mefarer v'zora l'ruach omatel ayam, right? There is no particular way. The way you need to do it is the way that gets rid of chametz. Okay? Now, how does this work? What's the machlokas? So Reb Chaim said as follows. Is it a question of you're not allowed to have chametz on Pesach? Meaning, that's an Isser Gavra. I, you know, the Eli are not allowed to have chametz on Pesach. Or no. There's a mitzvah that chametz has to be destroyed. Right? It's an Isser Chavtza. Now, Reb Chaim explained the sugya that way. So the question is, how does this benefit us? So here's an example. Rabbi Akiva Eger asked the question, whether the afar of burnt chametz is mutter or asar. Okay? So the answer to the question is a very simple one. If it's a din b'cheftza, that you have to burn chametz, then once you burn the chametz, na'aseh mitzvaso, meaning you got a mitzvah, the chametz no longer exists. And so, of course, then, afar o mutter, because you did what you were supposed to do, and then the ashes of a fire that had chametz is going to be mutter. But if hashbasaso b'chol davar, if there's no direct way to destroy chametz, right? It's just that the chametz can't exist. Then it's a din b'cheftza. Then afar al asur, because the whole point of burning it is to get rid of the chametz. And if some part of it is left, then you can eat that part. Now, Reb Chaim didn't make up the words gavra and chafza. Right? They're terms in the Gemara, but they're limited to nedarim and nezirus. Okay, is a neder, you know, is a gavra and is a chafza, is a nazir and is a gavra, is a chafza. But Reb Chaim took the terms gavra and chafza and expanded them well beyond. The best way to look at it is the idea of a chafza Reb Chaim used to describe something that's inherent and something that's external. If it's inherent, then it's asur b'cheftza, unrelated to gavra cheftza. It's just asur b'cheftza. I'll give you an example. Let's do it this way. Okay, tefillah. There are two types of davening. There's a tefillah chova, and there's a tefillah nedava. Okay? Now, how does this work? Shachris and mincha are what? Chova, for sure. Maariv? So it depends. What does it depend on? Well, once Maariv was a Nedava, or let's say less than Chova, meaning Maariv was not obligatory, right? But then Klal Yisrael took upon themselves the fact that they're going to daven every night, and Maariv became obligatory. Now let's read a Rambam together that Reb Chaim explains for all of us. It's a famous Rambam. It's Hilchos Tefillah, Perek Yud Halacha Vav. Mi shenistapek lo im itpalel im lo itpalel. Okay, you can't remember if you davened. If you took a flight, it could happen to you. Eino chozer umitpalel, right? You don't repeat. Why? It's a suffik drabanan, suffik brachos lahakel. Ela im kein mitpalel tfilazo al dat shehi nidava. But you, how do you get away with davening other Shmona Esrei? You say, I'm davening a tfilas nidava. Okay, there is such a thing as tfilas nidava. If a person wanted to say tfilas nedava all day long, to repeat Shmona Esrei over and over again, that's perfectly fine, so long as he makes it clear that he's davening a tfilas nedava, a voluntary davening. Next. Misha ya omeid bitfila v'nizkar shekvar hitpalel. A person in the middle of Shmona Esrei says, I can't believe it, I already davened Maariv on the plane. Posek va'afilu be'emtza bracha. He has to stop immediately because you have no excuse. However, ve'im haita tfilat arvid, but if it was Maariv, eino posek, you don't have to stop. Shelo hitpalel otam mitchila elo aldat she'eina chova. Says the Rambam, if you're davening Maariv, so you know that Maariv is in a dava, it's not a chova. And says the Ravid, ein kan nachas ruach. Loosely translated as like, right? I don't think so. So what's really going on? So for the Rambam, so Reb Chaim says as follows, and once he says it, you can't think of another way. He says, for the Rambam, Maariv is a tefilas nedava, bechevtza, meaning there's nothing you could do about it. It's true that we all daven Maariv as an obligation, but it's not. It was created later on. So the chevtza of Maariv is a tefilas nedava, even if our obligation to daven Maariv is a chovas gavra. It's almost like you're saying, I have a chova to daven tfilas nedava, right? So once that's the case, so of course the Maariv that you're davening from the start, the character of that Maariv is what? It's a tfilas nedava. So I can start davening Maariv thinking it's a regular Thursday night and I have to daven Maariv, right? I'm obligated to daven this tfilas nedava. In the middle, I realize I already davened. Says the Rambam, you can continue davening. Because it's bechevtza a tfilas nedava, even if, as bizarre as it sounds, begavra am chayev to daven Maariv. Anybody with me at all?
Yeah.
Okay. For the Ravid, no. It's a chevtza of a tfilas chova. Because once Klal Yisrael accepted on themselves to daven Maariv, the nature of Maariv changed. Right? So Reb Chaim's not here to say that the Rambam's right and the Ravid's wrong or the opposite. Reb Chaim is just here to define the terms. And once you define the terms, everything falls into place. Good? We'll do one more example. This is maybe the most famous one. Says the Rambam in Perek Dalet Halacha Tezvav of Hilchos Tefillah, Kol Tefillah She'eina B'Kavana Eina Tefillah. Says the Rambam, if you don't have Kavana, you didn't daven. V'im hitpalel below kavana, chozer mitpalel b'kavana. Right? You have to daven again. If you daven without kavana, you have to repeat davening. Why? So the Rambam would say, because you simply did, you think you davened, but davening is not the act of reading words from a sitter. Davening is the act of engaging with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you didn't have any kavana, you didn't daven. Okay? Next, halacha, kesadia kavana. Sheyifne et libo mikol ha'machshavot v'yireh atzmo ki'ilu hu omed lifnei ha'shchina. Right? What does it mean, kavana? To clear your mind and imagine that you're standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The problem is, in Perek Yud, the Rambam sounds otherwise. He says, mi shehit palel v'lo kivein et libo Yachzor v'yitpalel b'kavana. Says the Rambam, if you didn't have kavana, you have to repeat it with kavana. V'im kivein et libo b'bracha rishona, shuv eino tzarech. But if you had kavana in the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, that's all you need. So what's going on? In Perek Dalet, the Rambam said that if you daven, you don't have kavana, you didn't daven, you have to repeat. In Perek Yud, the Rambam says, no, if you had kavana for the first bracha, that's good enough. So what's the answer?
Different types of kavana.
Huh?
Different types of kavana.
Correct. So you could just say, two ways. The Rambam said there are different definitions of kavana. In the first halacha, the Rambam is talking about the kavana that you are omed lifnei Hashem. Okay? If I know that I'm davening, what does it mean to omed lifnei Hashem? It means I know that I'm davening. I know that I'm talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu right now. Okay? What's the other type of kavana? Perish HaMilos. So in the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, says the Rambam, without Perish HaMilos, you have to repeat. I need to know what I'm saying. I need to know the translation of what I'm saying. In the rest of Shmona Esrei, if you know that you're standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you're aware of the fact that you're davening, which is, by the way, why people should generally go to shul. So if you're in shul, you're pretty much assuring yourself that even without any kavana, you have basic kavana being omed lifnei Hashem. If you're in your living room, it's easy to forget, even that you're davening. Okay? So again, in each of these cases, all Reb Chaim is doing is explaining basic terms, explaining basic concepts, which can be used all over Shas if you want it, right? When the Gemara says, you need kavana for Shkitas HaPesach. Okay, you could ask yourself, what does that kavana mean? Is it Omer Difnei Hashem? It's obviously not Perish HaMilos. It's nothing, you don't have anything to say. Each of these things, answers all the questions. So for example, it sounds like it's a reaction. So for example, if you look at like Shirim Zozecha Abba Mari, the Rav Shirim for Yardside for his father, they all start with like a long series of questions. And they're like, oh my God, this is really terrible. And then the Rav saves the day and he answers all the questions. So Rav Lichtenstein said, he didn't learn that way. It's not like he kept a whole list of questions and then one day he had this like brilliant insight. It's how he gave shir. But it's not just that, I have questions, I'm going to answer them. That's how you give a shir because it's more exciting and it helps people focus. But probably, these ideas were floating around in his head to begin with. In terms of like Brisker Lumdus, the innovation that Lichtenstein had, which I think was an innovation, was you don't need the questions to get the answers. I'll explain. It's like, okay, on the one hand, you have two Rambams, and they're inconsistent, and so you come along and say, well, there's two types of kavana, right? But Rav Lichtenstein said, well, what if you thought of it first? What if when you came across a sugya in the Gemara, and the Gemara used the term kavana, you stopped and you asked yourself, what are the types of kavana? Or what does the Gemara mean when it says kavana? It's possible, if you follow a priori thinking, which is just think these things through in advance, it's possible that when you saw the Rambam and he had the stira, because in one place he says without kavana he didn't daven at all, in another place he says you only need kavana for the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, the answer would be, oh yeah, I already thought about this. It must be that the first bracha of Shmona Esrei needs kavana of Perish HaMilos, and the rest of Shmona Esrei only needs kavana of Omed Lifnei Hashem. It's possible that you would know the answers before you saw the stiros. Right? Again, when Reb Chaim did it, it was like, this is the problem, now let's answer the questions. But as Brisker Lumdus develops, I think you can answer the questions before you see the problems. Yes?
What's better about that?
You have no problem.
You have a problem either way.
Yes, but you have to be lucky. Meaning it's possible that you see two different types and you say, oh, they must be two different things, right? I think it's better if all along you knew that there are two different types of kavana. Maybe better is the wrong word. I'm not criticizing anything. I'm just saying I think it's an advancement in Brisker Lumdus. Maybe it's not. I think the more you can anticipate before you look in the text, the better off you are. I think it's more fun. Yes?
Also, when you said in response to the case where the questions don't come up, that you need a question, you don't understand and you get the answer.
I think you're right. Yeah. Yes.
It's interesting because when the chapter came to speak, he was telling us that he thinks one of the big problems in Sunni Shabbat is that people try to make fakirs all the time, but then if they study enough, they'll see that it's two gemaras. So it sounded like Rav Schechter preferred that you study more, and then you see the contradictions, and then you'll see that it's a fakir instead of trying to create it a priori.
I think you're right in terms of what Rav Schechter thinks. Okay. Rav Chaim was not a posek. Okay, all kinds of discussions why Rav Chaim never wrote tshuvos. I think it's because Rav Chaim, you know, saw things differently and didn't want to upset halacha, to be honest with you. Like, he was the Rav of Brisk, but there was a posek of Brisk, right? That wasn't what he did. What did he do? He did chesed. This is really an incredible thing. When you go, Rav Chaim died in Warsaw. He never lived in Warsaw, but he died. He's buried next to the Nitziv. Anybody who goes to Poland is going to go visit the Kvaros. And if you go there, on Rav Chaim's kever, it says he was a chassid. Like, it talks about his chesed. It doesn't talk about the fact that he was the biggest gadol in the world. Okay? This is really a unique thing. In Brisk, people talk about Rav Chaim's house as being public property. Like, anybody who needed a place to stay went there and stayed. It's really, you know, it's really incredible. People used to hang up signs in his living room, like looking for work. Or, you know, I do this. It was completely open in terms of what it was. The story goes that somebody described Reb Chaim's house to Reb Velvel, his son, as being Rishus HaRabim. And Reb Velvel said, no, no, no. In a Rishus HaRabim, there are rules. You can't just sleep in the middle of the street because people are walking by. They might trip over you. In my father's house, people slept wherever they wanted, right? It's really, you know, it's beyond anything we can imagine. And in terms of, I tell you, Rav Zevin thought Rav Chaim was thought of as the greatest person ever because of his learning. But I suspect it's also because of his chesed. And now, the question is, you know, how does that work? So the Rav once told a story that when his father, Rav Moshe, was becoming a rabbi for the first time, Rav Chaim said to him, the only thing you need to do as a Rav is chesed. That's all. And the stories of Rav Chaim doing chesed are incredible. You know, in Rav Lichtenstein's piece about the source of faith is faith itself, it's very short, everybody should read it. So he tells a story that Rav Chaim used to wake up in the middle of the night to look on his front steps to see if somebody had left a baby. People did that. They couldn't afford to take care of their children. They left it, you know. And then he thought to himself, just as an aside, Rav Lichtenstein thought, okay, if I have a question about something in halacha, or if I have a doubt about God, am I more moral than Rav Chaim, who couldn't sleep through the night because he was afraid somebody left a baby? No. It must be my lack of emuna, as opposed to the fact that I'm the most moral person in the world and, you know, I don't know how this halacha works. But these are the stories they told about Reb Chaim. He told his son that chesed was the thing that matters most. You know, people did leave babies at his house, parents who couldn't afford them, and Reb Chaim took care of the baby. Reb Chaim and his wife used to pay wet nurses. They didn't have formula. So they had to nurse babies who didn't belong to them. He took care of single mothers. He never asked them, like, how this happened. He loved Jews, and the fact that, obviously, if you're a single mother, you know, it wasn't like a miracle birth. You must have done something wrong. Never bothered him, never something that he got involved in. Apparently, he took care of mamzerim. Like, I don't know where they would come from or how he would know, but that's a big deal. Okay, Reb Chaim did not think, to get back to the Rav Schechter story, Reb Chaim did not think that every chakir was helpful, right? Like, he believed in chakiros, that's how he learned. But he didn't think that every chakir was helpful. There's a famous story that a certain Gaon, I'm not going to say his name, but his second name was Gaon. His first name was something else, okay? So he was talking and learning with Reb Chaim, and he raised the chakira of, like, a kedushin. Is it one and done, meaning you get married and you're married your whole life? Or is it like a recurring kinyan? Like every day, ki'ilu, you remarry your wife. And so Chaim was not impressed with the chakira. And he said to him, Mazel tov. So he said, you just got married. You know, and then like 15 minutes later, he said to him, oh, mazel tov. You know, the point is he didn't think it was helpful in learning. He didn't think it was truthful. And so he didn't believe in every chakira. But, yes? How could he not? There's no such thing as a machlokes in the tzu. I think it's cloudy now. You think it's sunny.
How do you define cloudy? Cloudy is with clouds. Of course,
there are machlokeses in mitzvahs. There have to be. That's not lamdos. That's just the question. I have to figure out what this thing is. I don't think it's a big deal to have a chakir about what the fact is. Once you have the fact, now I think, is the fact a gava or a chavtza? Is the fact a nedava or a chova? What? What?
The actual is just in the fact, and there should be a machlokes that you can check out that fact.
Something very
good. So which one is it? Which one is it? Huh? Okay, again, I don't think it's lumdus to have this machlokas. I think you have to have this machlokas to get someplace in learning. You have to know what you're defining. Okay, anyway, everybody have a great day.
Thank you.